Thank you, John. I'd like to I'd like to, first of all, on behalf of Jim and myself, thank the organizers for inviting us, particularly Vera Frankel, Joyce Siemens, and John O'Brien. And we hope that those of you who knew Judith will sense some resonances between her work and ours. Our curatorial practice is devoted to the interrogation and rethinking of the practices of display. Is this working? Okay, let's get it. What's happening here? Okay, is that better? I think it just needs to be quite close. Is that better? No? Yes? Okay. The main objective of our organization, Display Cult, is to mobilize artistic and critical strategies to stretch conventional boundaries of the aesthetic and engage with corporeal aspects of experience. We aim to creatively merge disciplines, media, and communities and to propose alternative exhibition prototypes. Our methodology blends four approaches: cultural studies, a tactical orientation, and a concern for affect and the use of performativity.
First, we draw from cultural studies several theoretical paradigms that we translate into curatorial practice. Second, our subject position as independent curators entails uncertain modalities of agency. As independents, our practice is provisional. We work tactically in Michel de Certeau's use sense of the term.
Third, while employing a full range of representational rhetorics, we are simultaneously interested in the extra-discursive aspects of aesthetic engagement, the mood and experience of exhibition context, what we term an aesthetics of affect. Beyond the closures of meaning, affect is located in the non-discursive, the non-representational, the fluctuating realms of pre-signification. Affect not only precedes meaning, but also exceeds and occupies the interstices of discourses, the passage between bodily states, the transformations of becoming.
It is through immersive embodiment that the atmospheric charge and intensity of an exhibition space, its conjunctures of historical, political, and social structures of feeling, can be staged and discerned. In this way, effective engagement is commensurable with recent recuperations of the aesthetic as a modality of pre-critical cognition. Today, we will describe four case studies that involve performative and effective engagements, each foregrounding epistemological concerns and oriented to productively shifting museological and exhibitionary aesthetics. Because of the complex nature of some of these projects, only partial glimpses can be provided. We extend our apologies to the artists who are not able to be discussed.
Counterposes. Could we have the slides? Counterposes, produced in 1998, involved conceptualizing a display genre which functions as both exhibition and event. We invited artists to reimagine tableau vivant, with a traditional form on the left, and incorporate themselves into elaborate site-specific contexts. 12 peopled installations were staged simultaneously throughout an entire building. The exhibition involved extensive research into what we have termed living display, the staged presentations of human beings. These include living creches initiated by St. Francis of Assisi in the 12th century, Renaissance ceremonial pageants, and tableau vivant, which became immensely popular in the 19th century as a domestic pastime, a means for moral instruction, and at times even a form of erotic entertainment. Other, less benign forms of human exhibition, carnival sideshows, punishment spectacles, and ethnographic showcases, reduced handicapped, dispossessed, or simply non-Western individuals into curiosities and exotica. In current media culture, living displays are pervasive in the phenomena of supermodels, bodybuilders, living museums, and photo opportunities. With new technologies claiming corporeal transcendence, living displays instantiate a recuperation of the body as a site of experience and knowledge. The living displays of counterposes compelled a reevaluation of the issues endemic to the activity of viewing and cultivated an attached, embodied, interested, and ethically implicated relationship. This doubled gaze, a looking compounded by being looked at, set up an intersubjective dynamic, a reciprocal engagement that confounded the privileged viewing normally operative in one-way sort of visual display culture. The encounters of counterposes encouraged viewers to acknowledge their own complicity in viewing practices and provided a framework in which to renegotiate the politics of beholding.
Colette's performances place the female body at the intersection of historical and cultural myths. In a largely Catholic neighborhood, she held a storefront audience from a majestic throne. By inviting people to come forward and to be blessed, she claimed the eminence of theocracy, a domain traditionally denied women by the church.
David McFarlane strapped himself into a fiberglass ball. Like a psychosocial experiment in trust and abuse, viewers could roll the sphere and watch the face of the artist inside. Most people were respectful, but as the crowd gathered, actions became more physical. One boy, whom we dubbed Bart Simpson, gleefully tested the limits of the artist's composure.
Shauna Dempsey and Lori Millan reconstituted the three graces in 70s dresses with protruding faucets and gushing water. The aspirational aspects of 19th century tableau vivants were updated to address contemporary nostalgia, specifically how department store catalogs function not only as a tool for consumption, but as manuals for constructing identity. Bridging the divide between macho hardware and femme evening gowns, their wry hermaphroditism hinted at gender fluidity and polymorphist desire.
Traveling upstairs, one entered the vortex of a fierce storm. Amidst dizzying sounds, Louise Littlefeld leaned out over the stairwell like a ship's figurehead. Ensconced in an apocalyptic whirlwind, spectators witnessed the artist deliberately pushing beyond her threshold of endurance.
And on the left there is Nellie Grimard, who invoked the ritual of a hospital visit. Viewers entered an artificially heated space with the artist asleep on a gurney bed. The apparent passivity of Grimard strategically amplified visitors' own predilections. Some pulled up her blankets caringly, making sure she was comfortable. Others felt provoked and harassed her to awaken.
Christine Martin redirected the display conventions of burlesque to comment on New York City real estate shifts, specifically the renovation of Times Square and the banishment of adult entertainment. Martin's, what she terms method go-go, rode the edge between a feminist celebration of sexuality and a critique of porn's exploitation, and challenged visitors to contemplate their own assumptions about innocence, sex, and display.
Kim Don and Christoph Migon engaged in overtly physiological activities of sucking, eating, and spitting. Amidst fermenting and putrefying candy, fruit, and honey, their abject picnic blurred the boundaries between food and excrement, disgust, and pleasure. The second case study is the servant problem. We staged the servant problem in 1999 at Eldon House, a residence built in 1834 in London, Ontario, and donated, contents and all, to the city in 1960 as a museum. Our project was one of several residencies interrogating the colonialist history of the house, hosted by Jamili Hassan under the title Trespassers and Captives. Our series of performative tableaux addressed the situation of servanthood as a social phenomenon and focused on the lives of servants in a house that is, for the most part, a monument to private ownership. Our adoption of the personas of a 19th century maid and a 20th century security guard referenced the dual identity of Eldon House as both a home and a museum. The servant problem utilized the museum as a stage, transforming an edifice of certain meanings and established history into one of contestation and reconfiguration. Invading the rooms closed off to anyone except authorized personnel, we sought to deterritorialize the univocal scripting of the space and confront visitors with Deleuzian minor perspectives.
The security guard and three Eldon House mannequins assume a classical tableau vivant theme, the judgment of Paris. Impersonating the social position of his employer, he relieves the pent-up frustration of preserving luxury but always being denied its pleasures.
The maid mirrors a 19th century engraving of a woman considering marriage. She holds two fortune-telling cards, love and calamity. For a maid, falling in love, getting pregnant, or expressing personal desires could lead to punishment, fines, or dismissal.
A video monitor shows the guard bound by rope. His shouts for help resonate throughout the house. While surveillance cameras are designed to capture trespassers, here it is the guard who is on view. The policing of museum behavior is overwhelmed and its vulnerability to transgression exposed.
In the dining room, legs protrude from the table. Does this immodesty evidence a tryst or foul play? In the next room, a monitor shows the maid neglecting her duties, evading surveillance by her mistress. She poaches from the library and reads forbidden literature, romance novels, and palm-reading manuals.
At the front door, the security guard intimidates visitors with humiliating inquiries. He reintroduces the gatekeeping hierarchy to the municipal institution, a reminder that, as a privately owned house, entrance may have been prohibited to those outside the approved social elite.
And at the same time, the maid greets people as they exit. She courteously brushes off and collects any Eldon House dust that may have accumulated during their visit. Obsessing over the implementation of, quote, museum standards, she makes sure that not even a particle of the institution leaves the premises.
Vital signs. Vital signs from 2000 explored how the noun visual senses are being reconceived in contemporary artistic practice. Concurrent with the exhibition, we organized with several other academic colleagues an international academic conference on common senses at Concordia University, which brought together 185 speakers from diverse interdisciplinary fields. Presentations addressed the subtle but powerful links between the senses, cultural politics, and aesthetic meaning. The title of the exhibition, Vital Signs, embodied medical and semiotic references. Our curatorial intent was to take the pulse of this shift towards the experiential. While the non-visual senses may appear to operate transparently in perception, there is nevertheless a politics at work which raises significant issues about how knowledge is produced. Artworks incorporating the non-visual sense are uniquely mutable. They call for a new conceptual framework that can account for how they function simultaneously as material and idea, stimulus and sign, objects to be interacted with, and ones that are transformed by the very act of apprehension. Ultimately, we wanted to pose a series of questions that we are still in the process of investigating. What lies beyond the scope of the aesthetic gaze? How do artworks involving taste, touch, and smell transgress and reconceive definitions of art? In what manners can hegemonic understandings of the senses be reconfigured?
Chris Ann Stathakos's vending machine pervade wish-fulfilling aromatic oils. Drawing from the folk culture of India and satirizing the panaceas offered by Western commercial products, it addressed sense mythological properties to evoke fantasy and transcendence.
As an artist and engineer, Natalie Jeremijenko conducts experiments involving aesthetics, biology, and technology. Her works range from critiques of science to playful and practical inventions. This interactive sculpture tracks the vocal impressions of each handler, recording and playing provocative sound bites.
Sandra Rachico dissolved viewer distanciation by making tactile participation integral to the work. Beholders were invited to walk on glass and overcome their sense of danger. Sensory prejudgment achieved visually was defied by the exhilaration felt as each step displaced the sharp edges into a cushioning crunch.
Wendy Jacobs' somatic sculptures engaged a postural and tactile aesthetics. The velvety embrace of the squeeze chaise longue was at once therapeutic and calming. Designed in collaboration with Temple Grandin, this kinesthetic technology has also been used to treat autistic patients and to foster the humane slaughter of livestock.
And then concurrent with the conference and with the Vital Signs show, we held a performance salon called Sentience, where audiences witnessed, among six performances, a springtime smell ritual by Pierre Baudouin on the left. Performed Disco Tatami with Kevin DeForest on the right, and photographed their auras with Chris Ann Stathakos. And our last project, Museopathy. Our concept for the project of Museopathy from 2001 pivoted on cultivating a reciprocating dynamic between art and non-art objects, the apex of the White Cube and the Heritage Museum. Involving three interrelated parts, the exhibition spread throughout the city of Kingston. As guest curators, Jennifer and I invited 10 artists to create site-specific interventions in museums. Display Cult also produced a related performance event in pathology, commissioning four performance artists to intervene in selected sites. The third component, collectioneering, arranged non-art objects borrowed from the city's museums in groupings we termed dialectical constellations. The resulting postmodern Wunderkammer included placing prisoner escape ropes and ladders, including Ty Cahn's notorious ladder, alongside Jacob's Dream by Paolo di Mattei, attesting to the interlinkages between emancipatory fantasies across social formations. Another indexical allegory juxtaposed The Good Samaritan by Lambert Jacobs with a canvas stretcher from World War I, two examples of compassion across historical eras. And a vitrine of shivs, surgical items, and an executioner's knife evoked comparisons between lethal inventiveness and the viscerality of medical procedures. The title, Museopathy, combines museo, museum, with the suffix pathy, alluding to the pathways that link the citywide show, and pathos, emotion or feeling. Despite the hint of things pathological, museopathy was premised on a homeopathic logic in which like treats like, and that is, each artist mimicked aspects of museum display in order to generate their work. Museopathy explored the implications of museological affect, how museums subtly influence visitors, the erratic qualities of museums, their particular moods and ambiances, were highlighted, intensified, or counteracted in order to examine meanings that may be lost due to the necessity of conveying monologic rhetorics. Aesthetic sensibility thus operated as a means by which feelings accompany the processes of coming to know, linking pathic and epistemological modalities. Importantly, the focus on the act of intervention emphasized the performative nature of museum visits. The demanding itinerary engaged an entire exhibitionary network, which was just as important as any individual artwork or site. By merging art and artifacts in a mutual relationship, the project inspired a dialogue between traditionally separate domains of aesthetics, history, popular culture, science, and tourism.
Into Bellevue House's period rooms, once inhabited by Sir John A. Macdonald, Mel Ziegler introduced 50 objects purchased from mail-order catalogs and the Internet. Relating museum collecting activity to antique buying and decorating trends, the artist positioned the museum within the larger network of historical aura and the search for authenticity.
Well, these slides are dark, but there's an electric guitar on the right, and there's an executive putter set, as well as post-it notes and antique-style Victorian glasses in the study on the left. Inspired by prisoners' ingenuity, Brian Jungen responded to an infamous object in the Correctional Service Museum, an escape pod fashioned from hollowed-out lunch trays. The colors of Jungen's sculpture also point out the disproportionality of indigenous inmates in the prison population.
The Murney Tower was not only a soldier's barracks, it was also a home for their wives and families. By revealing the domestic dimensions of this defensive military structure, Anne Ramsden drew out lesser-known historical realities through incongruous objects, fictional autobiographical texts, and a faux garden encircling the tower.
Mitch Robertson commented on the practices of commemoration and merchandising that produce celebrities in both athletic and aesthetic realms. He activated the Ice Hockey Museum with artistic versions of hockey cards, arena banners, and the creation of the world's largest ball of hockey tape.
John Dixon explored the popular fascination with
the museum ship Alexander Henry. Linda Montano merged art and life, converting the nautical interior into a retreat for the navigation of personal exculpation. With Jessica Wyman, she staged a self-empowering ritual for relaxation, self-examination, and the fostering of forgiveness.
Adopting the role of interviewer, Clive Robertson collected opinions about Kingston's museums. Meeting with visitors and cultural critics, he created an audio archive of conversations about the politics of collecting tourism and interventionist practices.
And on the left, Peter Hobbs embodied the notion of empathy literally. Struck by the suffering of Sir John A. Macdonald's wife, Isabella, the artist responded emotionally to the melancholia of Bellevue House. Using acting, therapeutic, and visualizing techniques, he expressed the effective energies of artifacts and challenged the taboo of crying in public.
For 30 years, Mortimer represented the typical Royal Military College student at the RMC Museum. Diane Borsato honored the 1940s mannequin by taking him out of the museum and into the rituals of graduation weekend. The two met with military officials, marched in a parade, and had a romantic evening at the prom.
Well, in conclusion, one feature of modernism that we feel demands problematizing is the onus on disciplinary specialization. In terms of practice, we prefer to deliberately blur the boundaries between artist, curator, entrepreneur, critic, academic, and other situational subject positions. Our interest in alternative curating and its methodologies develops not out of a concern for reclaiming connoisseurship or revising institutional programming per se, but to mobilize curating as a conceptual practice. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jennifer and Jim. Maybe we could flicker up the light. Oh, fantastic. They were supposed to flicker to sort of get everybody up, unaesthetic though it may be. And I suppose, Melanie, can you be seen down there?